good to have you to chat to you about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. I will tell you one little thing. It's so weird that how this panned out. Aside from Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy and Iron Man, I have never seen a superhero movie until yesterday.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, so you went into it without knowing context or background or anything. Oh my gosh, of the characters.
Yeah, wow. So Guardians of the Galaxy was something that I kept hearing about for the longest time, especially I'm a huge fan of Spielberg, and he even said publicly that it's one of his favorite films. So I watched the first two. I haven't seen the third one yet. I just didn't get a chance to go to the movie theater. But I watched the first two, and it made sense to me why it's liked by people, because it had a lot of nostalgia, of course, a lot of, even some of the characters and the way the lines were reminded me of Han Solo, Star Wars, Indiana Jones. There was that quirkiness to it. And I enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed watching it. And so for me, it was very important that I always try to do films that I know about, but I wanted to try something a little different. And with Guardians of the Galaxy kind of on my back, back of my head, and thought maybe we should try something and see where it goes. So nothing against the film or anything. I'm just being completely open with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for telling me. That way, in case I'm talking about something, you're like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
I mean, I did some research on your work and, on Nowhere and all that. So I have an understanding. But, I went through your IMDb. I mean, your work in Jurassic World, obviously. I mean, it's Jurassic Park. The original is one of my favorite films. And, so tell me about your journey into this world, just art direction in general. How did you get into it? What was it like to begin with?
I always loved storytelling since I was young, and pretty much every job I've had, I've had something to do with the entertainment industry. I didn't really know quite what I wanted to do until college. Before that, I had played around with animation or editing, sound. I just wanted to be part of filmmaking. Eventually, I found out it was films, not necessarily books. I love books, but I was trying to find that path. And in high school, that gave me an opportunity to play around with some ideas. And I thought I wanted to be in cinematography because of the creative control that you have. But until I took a production design class in college, I didn't realize what encompassed our department and what we do to create the sets and the setting and the emotional value through visuals that you get with the art department. And so I was raised in Texas. I was born in Colorado, raised in Texas, went to school there. I went to UT Austin. And if anybody knows Austin, they know that Austin is very much a film friendly, yep. Like very artist, film, music, video games now friendly. And so I was surrounded by a bunch of creative people who wanted to be in film as well. And then when I graduated, I was really encouraged by my professors to go out to Los Angeles and try my hand there. And at that point, I loved sketching, drawing. I loved creature design. I loved concept art. I had learned how to scenic paint in the theater department. And so I had all these skills, and moving out to LA, coincidentally enough, it was in 2008, which was in the middle of a writer's strike, which we are also in now.
Right.
And so I was told you moved to Los Angeles at the worst possible time. And it was 3 years of Craigslist jobs and independent films and tiny projects, which is really great education. And I always encourage that for people. Don't work for no money, but if you want to, that's your choice. And so when I first moved out to LA, there's a production designer named Michael Kornblith, And he went to UT Austin as well. And I met him in Austin through one of my professors, John Blood. And Michael told me, when you move out to Los Angeles, here's my email, email me. And he was one of the first person I did. And he was one of the first to respond. And he had a tiny little theater project that was potentially no pay, but I got paid $50. And I tell all this story because I did the project in LA. It was fantastic. I had such a great time. 3 years later, he, in keeping in touch with him over the years, he finally came back to Los Angeles after working out of state, had a job opportunity as a production assistant. And that was my foot in the door. I interviewed and got in on a film called Dinner for Schmucks, if anyone has seen it, with Paul Rudd and Steve Carell and Zach Galifianakis.
Oh, I gotta watch it now because nothing against you.
I know. It's a small film. It didn't do great at the box office, but it was wonderful. Like, a wonderful crew, great script. I had such a wonderful time. And after that, it's kind of this rolling ball. Once you get your foot in the door, and if you are positive and a hard worker and committed, and you show that commitment, it just became job after job after job. Long story short, until Michael called me again and asked if I wanted to, this was probably 4 years in, 3 to 4 years in, be on a film called Game Change, which was my next step into the union. And after that is another snowball effect of just show after show after show. Until it led to me being an art director. So it's a long process, and everybody has a different story, but mine went from PA, a little bit of coordination work, assistant art director for a number of years, and then art director.
Yeah. No, it's actually so true that, and I have this conversation with people all the time, that sometimes the people that you meet, you don't know how they're going to become a part of your life down the road. And it happens to all of us. And, you know, even the biggest setbacks, one of the projects, so I'm a filmmaker myself, and one of the projects that I was working on, we had a major setback and we decided to pull out from the production. But, you know, we lost money, which is, you know, it is part of the process. But one of the person who invested in that project believed in us so much more that just resonated step after step after step to next films. And had it not been for that setback, who knows what would have happened, right? So it's so imperative not to be despair when things are going down, because you just don't know what's being cooked in the background.
Oh, absolutely. I could not agree more. And on top of that, knowing that setbacks can be a benefit down the road and you can't see that in the future, there's also people you work with. Like, I'm always been somebody that you should always treat other people with kindness, not because it's going to benefit you, but But there are people who were PAs that are now producers. There are people I went to school with who are now producers or writers or creators. And so you don't know what everybody's journey is. And speaking of a setback, the one that I always bring up is actually Jurassic World. So I was a huge Spielberg fan. I still am. Huge influence on what I'm doing now. And the opportunity came up to be an assistant art director on Jurassic World, which was, for me, huge. And sure. I don't know what year it was. Maybe it was 2013 or 2014. Yeah. No, it was probably 2015. So when I got on it, it was the first round. I don't even know. There was like a whole like starter of Jurassic World. And then it went down. I was on the film for 2 weeks and before it collapsed. And I was so distraught. I thought, this is the like one of the things I wanted the most in the world. And I, you know, after much despair, Michael, again, he found out that everybody was available and he got us on a job that fall. And then Jurassic came back up next year and I got to still be on it. So the hindsight is always 20/20, but I think after this has happened a few times more to me in my life, things going down or meeting people and then working later with them and not knowing, like you said, that it's a journey and you don't know where that journey leads. So you have to kind of go with the flow. You have to be open. You do.
And I'll give you an example about this podcast. So the way this podcast started was in 1997, when I was in university, I started a website on Steven Spielberg.
Oh my gosh. That's so cool.
And that turned into DreamWorks Studio fan site. And it was huge because I was the only one. And I, you know, getting to go to sets, attending press junkets, premieres, all that stuff. And then 2007, I shut it down because DreamWorks Studio was kind of going down and I wanted to pursue my film career. And my wife always kept telling me over the years that, why did you shut the website down? It would have opened so many doors for you. I'm like, I don't know. I just did. And then pandemic happened and I started this podcast on DreamWorks Films again, Kingdom of Dreams, this podcast that we're on. And we interviewed so many people and I'm like, okay, now let's start to expand it to other films. Now let's start to expand to new films. So that's something that ended 15 years ago. And my interest reignited because of that. If it hadn't done that website, I probably wouldn't be doing the podcast at all, period.
Oh, well, so really? That's amazing.
It is so weird how things happen, right? And you just don't see them as they're happening. And it's so true that you have to stick to your guns and you have to keep believing that things will work out. And, you know, if they're meant to be and they're good for you, they will for sure.
Yeah. And following your passion, something that you said where you did this because you loved this material. And I think that that's something that I've always tried to encourage. And I have to look at myself sometimes. Why am I doing certain things or why do I want certain projects? And instead of it, never looking at it as like, oh, I want to do this because I want the credit or I want the notoriety. Do it because you love to do it. And the more you do that, like even if it fails, at least you loved doing it. And because there are many people out there who are not quote unquote as successful, but successful is all in the eye of relative. The beholder.
It's a relative term.
It's a relative term, totally. And I've just been super lucky enough to get on these projects with people who are also as nerdy as me. And we get to just go create worlds together, which is something I did when I was young. Only it's just with more money.
And I'm glad you brought the money point. So money is obviously essential, right? But at the same time, my experience has been, if I am going to start something thinking the money in mind, which has happened twice, and both times I gave up on it because my heart was not in there. And that was a lesson learned for me that, yes, money should be, you're not doing stuff for free, but you have to have your heart and soul into it first. And then, you know, just keep at it because that's the only thing that's going to hold you back. It hold you to it, basically, essentially. It's just that passion and that drive because you become a child when you're doing something that you love. It doesn't have to be film, anything.
Absolutely. I've just reignited my passion in reading because I've been just working and working and working. And I remember just immersing myself in a book and in this world and just devouring it. And that love for a story is what keeps me going. And obviously you're going to for what I do, you're going to get on projects that sometimes you don't quite understand the script. You're not as passionate about, but I always try and find something like you said, where is your heart? Where can you find that thing that sparks your interest that makes you excited to get up in the morning to go and do whatever it is doing? And everybody's answer to that is different. Like my dad is a dog trainer. He loves working with animals and that is his passion. And that's what keeps him going and has sustained him his whole life of something he loves. And I just always encourage people and people who say, well, sometimes being an artist is what you love to do, but doesn't get you any money. And that's a question I think people have to ask themselves. And I think it's a question a lot of artists are asking themselves in the AI debate and the social media of it all. I don't have as many followers. I'm, you know, not as popular, but if it's not you and it's not true, I think people see through that. And I think
true. People now, people see genuineness so clearly. Like, that's something that, you know, news versus a podcast by Joe Rogan or somebody else, you know, people see through that. And that's, people like genuineness, period. Mm-hmm. And the camera never lies. You know, anytime I have interviewed a subject for my documentary, I can tell in a matter of seconds if they're BSing or not. It's so obvious. Like, I can tell if they're just giving a dramatic twist to it, or if they're just BSing, or if they're lying. Because you can see it in the eyes. You can so easily see in the eyes of people when they're talking. And yes, I mean, there's emotional baggage, sometimes biases people have. We all do towards certain things, which is fine. But at the end of the day, you know, genuineness works like a charm. And that's something that I really try on this podcast too, is that just let myself go and just don't worry about anything. But one thing I completely avoid is political debates. Like, I just don't want to talk about anything politics, because that's going to open up another can of worms and it's not worth it.
Authenticity, I think, for me, is one of, like, the pillars of how I've tried to live my life. And I've not always been perfect, but something that you said, you look at people and can see it. I look the same. And that, whether that's an artist, a writer, an actor, a designer. And I've been lucky enough, I think, in my career to encounter so many people who are authentic and push us all to be as authentic as possible, instead of trying to people please, instead of trying to fit the norms. Like, I was just, I don't know where I just saw this, that Denis Villeneuve for Dune was asking his crew to meditate and not do Google searching. And I went, wow, that's cool. Like, you know, because it's a different way of trying to ask you to be your most authentic self and be creative and free. Like, obviously we do a lot of Google searching and in our research, and try and base our world off of what we know as human beings on Earth exist. And so we're not copy and paste, which I know there's a lot of criticism in some of the films we do. There's a lot of copy and paste, but I can tell you from where I'm sitting, there's as much authenticity that we bring as an art department to a set. So that when you step on to a set, whether you're a crew member or an actor, director, that you are immersed in a world, and to watch people's eyes like light up like they are kids. It's like, oh, right, we're just big kids, just making all this fun stuff, you know, to tell a story, to hopefully change people's lives for the better.
True. It's so true. And, you know, talking about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, I think you worked on the holiday special, from what I saw on IMDb, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yes, we shot the holiday special parallel with the actual film. So there was obviously some actor scheduling. So we were a few months into filming Guardians and then had to do some reset on our sets for the holiday special. And so that shot, there was some stuff in LA that was shot as well. So my set was Nowhere. So that is the disembodied celestial head that we've seen before. But this time, not only did we have everything that happens in Volume 3, but we also had the lovely Christmas special. So you are correct.
Got it. And tell me what, you didn't work on the first two, right? But having to keep that in mind, but also bringing some original stuff from your DNA into it, is that, what was the process of that like? Like, where did the inspirations come from, if any? How did you go about doing the work? And you can speak that in general context of your work in general, like how what inspires you, what motivates you in the context of the Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3?
Oh, wow. Yes. So as an art department, we have a team of people, I would say an army of people, who all are bringing something creative to the table. And so when I came on, I had seen volume one and two, but I'll be completely honest, I didn't know it as in depth or as well as say something like Spider-Man, which I loved and grew up with and then got to work on. But so for me, it was kind of fresh and new. And when I stepped on board volume three, there was already some concept art that our concept illustrators had done. And there was some 3D models that had already been developed, kind of some big blocking, massing models, where certain pieces were on stage. And so when I came in, there was this massing idea of where things were. And then what I helped do is really tailor and guide the aesthetic through completion to shoot. For me, I came in going, oh my gosh, this is not my rhetoric. I have no idea. I don't know this world. So what I spent a lot of time doing at first was rewatched all the films. We also got the hard drive from the original films, and I dug into every single photo, every little detail, all the drawings that was done on Nowhere from volume one, from the incredible designer, Charles Wood, who has worked on many, many of the Marvel films, including Avengers Infinity War, which they had also done a section of Nowhere spaceport there. Thankfully, one of our art directors, David Scott, our supervising art director, it was Beth Mickel, our designer, Alan Hook, and David Scott were, Alan and Dave were the supervising art directors. And Dave had been the art director for the Nowhere spaceport in Infinity War. Mm-hmm. So it was very helpful for him to be able to tell me, that grading, we used this kind of grading, or this material, we used that. And so it really helped open my brain to how can I use real world materials, paint them, cut them up, put some light behind it. And when you put it on a wall, it looks like space stuff. So there was that. And there's so much. I think the major things for me were those images. Working with our set designers and developing this world, we started to call it space deco because we were like, what is this aesthetic? It's not Star Wars. It's not Captain America. It's not like we were trying to figure out what it was called. And so because we had so many different locations, the armory, the bar, the apartments, each place had its own aesthetic. And if you go back and rewatch or pay attention, each of those buildings have a very specific kind of style and color. And there's a lot in there. Every little detail was not overlooked. The colors are very specific. For me, I started out with looking at video games. Honestly, I didn't really know where to start. Beth, our incredible designer, she let me play in this world. And so I really started looking at video games and what are their color palettes, because it's fun, right? Quill is a video game kind of guy. And so like, I thought, well, it'd be fun if his color was like Donkey Kong, you know, like his room. And so that was really fun to develop that. So not only that, but there were other things we looked at, like, we all went as an art department down to Star Wars Land in Disney World. For us, it's also helped us with dressing. So our incredible decorator, Rosemary Brandenburg, had an incredible team of people. So all of the things that you see on screen that are in front of the wall and all of the cables and all of those Christmas lights, that's all her and her team. The tools on Rocket's shelf, his bedding, the shelving that has everything is labeled in the font of Nowhere. All of that stuff comes from, I would say, just a compendium of hours and weeks of research between Star Wars Land. I looked at something like Warhammer 40,000, but also looking at degraded abandoned factories. What Charles Wood did, and what existed before. And then the comics. I have to say, like, I had pages from the comics of what Nowhere looked like on my wall. So that if there was any doubt of like, what should I do about this detail in the door? Or how can I communicate something that's a bit of an Easter egg? I would be looking at the comics and that would help inform my decision. So long way of saying that it is just a giant bag of tricks. And sure. I am so grateful for my team who brought their own bag of tricks. So if I was ever struggling with something or if I didn't have as much of a guide, they would say, oh, well, I've used this before. I have this thing. Or what do you think of this? And I'd be like, brilliant. Let's do that. Yes. So yeah. So it's also a team effort, big team effort.
For sure. I mean, filmmaking is collaboration, no matter what department you're in. Yes. You know, even smaller films or major films. You know, one of the things that we all as human beings go through, like, you know, if we're sleeping or if we're walking or if we're doing something where we're not actually working, just relaxing, a lot of ideas come to our head, whatever that may be, like a concept of a film or a concept of art direction or whatever. Has there been a moment like that, whether it was Guardian of the Galaxy or any other film, where you had a eureka moment in the middle of the night and you decide to draw it or on the phone when you're walking?
Yes, but that is such a great question because it's so true. I would say for me, hiking is that thing. I get into nature and I'll just go for a few hours, help clear my head. You can't always do that when you're working sometimes in an office. You got to go, go, go. I have absolutely had the eureka moment in the past, and I'm trying to think of one on Guardians because I know I had it. There was definitely a few times of eurekas, a few times where you go, oh, could this work? This could work. I know on Spider-Man, there was a moment on No Way Home where I was trying to find the right reference to give our construction and sculpt and plaster department, who they're another incredible team of artisans that build our worlds. Like, we come up with all this fun stuff and then they're like, okay, now how are we going to actually do it? And they have a set of skills, real world skills. And I was struggling with how to get them the right the set that was mine was Dr. Strange's Sanctum Basement.
Yeah.
And one of them was the cave and the cave detail. And I remember struggling with trying to find the right images. And there was a location in Turkey that I knew was perfect, but I only could find a few Google search images of it. It might have been 4 a.m. I woke up and I was like, I wonder if there's one of those 360 panoramic views that exists of this ancient location in Turkey. And sure enough, there was. So I just dove in and started taking, like, zooming around and taking screenshots of all the details and took them into work. And I'd like to believe that they were helpful. I think they were for our plaster and sculpt department. But things like that. I think sleep helps. I've found sleeping helps as well to help clear your mind. Not getting enough sleep, you're clouded by judgment of things that you've seen throughout the day. If I think of another one, I'll let you know. But there was definitely a lot on Guardians.
Yeah. Sure. Did you work directly with James Gunn at all, or was it just more sort of like through other people that you worked with?
It was mainly through other people. So there was a few interactions. So the way a big film like this is run, there are supervising art directors who are Alan and Dave, and Beth, who is our production designer, is the head of the department. So as art directors, we are usually assigned specific sets. That's not always the case on smaller films, but so I would end up running a lot of things through Beth, Alan, and Dave because they are my superiors. And they were the ones sitting down for a lot of the meetings. However, there are definitely times where have to be there with James on a walkthrough with the actors to understand scale and height when we were first building Nowhere. And it was just a few sticks of lumber before we had put anything down. None of the dirt was down and everybody's walking through and we have little scale foam core cutouts of Rocket. And we had some of, for the other sets, we had Tiefs and Lila and Floor. And it really helps with a director and with actors to understand timing. How long does it take for characters to say their dialogue and walk from one place to another? So working with James on individual sets, yes. Like, and sometimes there's moments like the changeover we had for the destruction. I remember it was Beth and I, and we had this incredible scale model built by our model maker, Brett Phillips, and his assistant, Travis. And it was all white foam core. And we had all these little tiny rubble pieces, and we had to have a meeting while James was shooting, which is what we had to have a meeting about this changeover. And the only time he's there is sometimes he's so busy that it's during the middle of shooting. So we had to have the right time to be able to talk to him and show him there on the set, the scale model of like, where are we going to do all this destruction? So times like that, yes, you get to have direct interaction. And he's so creative and so funny and so smart that it's overwhelming sometimes to be like, oh gosh, I hope I did. Hope I'm seeing his vision through. But yeah. I just can't stop giving so much praise to Beth, Alan, and Dave. They were a huge part of why things look as brilliant as they do.
Yeah. I mean, the film set essentially, I like to look at it like as a chain of command, like a military unit, you know, like you have, you know, different people on the top and then medium and bottom and all that. And it's, you know, it's a collaborative effort. And unfortunately, you know, something that is, it has changed, and I wish there was more of it in the, when it comes to recognition, you know, yes, the director is the captain of the ship. And yes, you know, there's producer, art directors and stuff, but there are just so many unsung heroes, right? Like, for example, stuntmen or stuntwomen.
Oh, yes. You love, know, our stunt.
Like, nobody recognizes them. I mean, you look at someone like Tom Cruise, right? I mean, he's like a superstar. And he's done ridiculous, crazy stunts, and yet nobody has recognized him officially. It's insane. That
why I definitely watch him. Sorry.
No, I do too. I can't wait for the new MI7. I mean, I'm just dying to see that. But it's just, there's so many unsung heroes. Like, if you go sit through the credits at the end of the movie in a movie theater, and you know, you will have like maybe the first 8 slides, like, you know, the main ones, and after that the whole scroll kicks in, and then you're like, why are these people not talked about?
I know. I mean, and that's what I tell people. If they're trying to get into film, I say stick for the credits and look how many people there are. And if you're interested in a certain department, just look it up. Google is your best friend with that. Look up what these people do. And no part is too small. I mean, every person has such a giant part to play. And you know, as a filmmaker, everybody, you're from your PAs, your runners, are in our department, are set designers, graphic artists. And I think there were about 50 people in the art department. So, and that's just the art department. There are 200 people in construction and for 150 people in set deck. I may be exaggerating the set deck. No, I'm not sure.
I can imagine for a big film like that, for sure. I mean, you have to have that many people. I mean, just to, you know, obviously the budgets are so high, so that makes sense.
Yeah. And I'm always so appreciative and fascinated by these skills that people come in. Our prop makers and our metal workers. I had this incredible foreman, Sergei Mazarov, and he ran Nowhere. That was his set from beginning to end. He was there 5:30 in the morning until 6 p.m. at night. And he had to deal with structural issues and make it safe for the crew. That is That is not my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
And it is, I don't know if the photo will ever get released, but there was a photo of the all the crew that were left at the very end of filming, and they were all on the stairway and in front of the apartment building on the top level and the middle and below. And it's just massive what they created. And Chris Snyder, our construction coordinator, is like a force of nature. He, all those sets that you saw, the Arete, the Bowie, all of, I think a lot of people consider Marvel films as being all visual effects, and I love them. And I think they're an incredible department for the extensions, but James was very specific on Guardians about wanting to build as much as possible. And so if you see any behind the scenes stuff of what we did, we were incredibly fortunate to be able to build a lot of these sets. Yeah.
I mean, I noticed that with the first and the second one, I could tell which were practical sets and which were not. And that's what, for me, one of the reasons I shouldn't say, maybe I should. One of the reasons I have sort of stayed away from superhero films is because of that, so much visuals and so much explosions. And it, maybe when you're a kid, it's awesome, you know, when you're young. But for me, it wasn't. But when I saw Guardians of the Galaxy, I will admit there were some scenes that were way too much for me, but at the same time, there was enough to balance out with the practical effects versus the visual effects. Wherever there could be practical effects, there were. You know, obviously you can't have like a space, you know, in the middle of space, you can't have a practical effect for that, right? But anything else, whether it was a ship, whether it was a forest, whether it was just anything, you guys would actually go there. And then that's what I loved about the film the most, among many other things, is that there was that level of, again, going back to genuine, you know, being real. People like that stuff now. I think people have gone past all blazing out special effects, I feel. There are some exceptions, of course. But you know, one of the things that I'm really excited about, and I saw this in your IMDb after we contacted you, you're working on Francis Ford Coppola's film.
Yeah. So, actually, it's a bit of a funny story. So I was on that film for a few months in the fall, and that was from July until December. And then just to be completely honest, we had to walk away from the film in January with our designer, Beth, and David Scott. So sorry. Yeah. So okay. It was it's very unfortunate, but I look at that experience as being, one of the highlights of my life. I mean, how do you say no to that film? And I felt very grateful for the opportunity and the experience being on that project.
Great. No, that's fine. I'm not going to ask you any kind of juicy details. No. Don't worry. That's not my way of doing things.
I couldn't say even. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. Which is one of the reasons. But no, if you were to pinpoint something way in the beginning that gave you that bug of being involved in the film, was it a particular film that you saw or a moment that got you where you are right now?
I don't think it was moments. It was films. I would say Spielberg. Jurassic Park for sure.
Okay, Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park, Lord of the Rings, the original Lord of the Rings, were very influential. I remember, and Tim Burton films, I think, stuff like Nightmare. Of course, I'm very much a macabre lover, like occulty, macabre, dark stuff. So I always loved that. And creatures. I really did think for a hot second I was going to go be a creature designer, which I also would have loved. I love creatures. And horror. I love horror. And so those were films. Indiana Jones also for me was very influential. There were films I watched over and over and over again as a kid. E.T. So a lot of Spielberg. They were just some of the first I ever remember. And the first time I remember looking at the credits and seeing people's names and thinking, wait, there are people besides the actors that like they work on these films.
Yeah.
And that kickstarted an interest. And then of course, when I was in high school, Lord of the Rings had come out and The Matrix, that was a huge, when you saw The Matrix, maybe not so much now, but when it first came out and I saw it, I was
huge deal. It was a huge deal.
Like I'd forgotten how big of a deal it was. And that was another one where I was like, it just felt so different. And so for me, like that really kickstarted my interest in the production design. What did that mean? What did the sets mean? Getting to see what people built and painted and really felt so cool, just building these worlds and getting to live inside these worlds. I mean, it was my dream. It's like every kid's dream, getting to jump into a world. It was the dream I had when I was reading books and being like, I wish I could just be there. And now I get to do that. So yeah, I would say Spielberg and a lot of the Spielberg, like I mentioned, and Lord of the Rings.
It's crazy, you know, the fact that you just mentioned about what goes behind the scene. I think I became probably aware of that when I saw the making of Jurassic Park. I wasn't blown away by the amount of people that worked on it, but I was blown away by the amount of work that went into creating those dinosaurs.
Oh my God, yes.
from the design to animatronics to eyes, like all the, you know, finicky detail. And now it's become such a big thing. Like, you know, we actually believe that dinosaurs look like that. So every time I see a film that has dinosaurs and they don't look like the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, they can't be real because it sets such a precedent, right? And that's what popular culture does, I guess.
Well, you bring up a really, really great point. And I love I've loved science. I love the sciences since I was a kid. I love science. I still do. And the interesting debate, the cyclical nature of our industry, of art in general, how art influences cultures or how science influences art, and this nature of they all are kind of doing the same thing and kind of running in the same circles. And you can't quite pinpoint who is who. Like, did Star Trek come up with that first? Or did, some engineer come up with that first? And from where I'm standing, it's a bit of both. So what we do as creatives is we're looking at a lot of real world things and scenarios to give realism to a thing. But you're still you're taking your twist on it and making it fantastical. Sometimes, not always, but well, even in realism, right? You've seen movies. I've worked on movies that are based on real life people. There's still some liberty taken to tell a good story.
You have to,
or else, you know, there's plenty of documentaries you can go and see, but we're in the nature of the storytelling, and storytellers are always embellished. And so I, like you said, with dinosaurs, people's version of reality is based on fantasy versus reality. And I love that debate of like, where do our human folk tales and fables come from? They come from a modified version of real events. And what does that mean for realism? And does it matter for us as a society if we've told a story and it made a big difference in who we are, how much does realism still come into play? And how does that story actually influence science? Like, that's a crazy thought. That's a lot. That's, I feel like, another debate, but I love that you brought that up because I do see that and I acknowledge that. And just know that as artists making these films, we are out there paying attention on everything that's happening, artists, science, culture, politics, all of that, to influence what we do.
Right. you know, being on that conversation, you look at James Cameron, The Terminator, and you look at Steven Spielberg's AI, artificial intelligence, right, with Haley Joel Osment.
Yes.
And now we are living in that AI world. And, I mean, this is something that Netflix did recently. I haven't seen it. They made a short animated film completely out of AI. And there was a lot of protest by the animators. And I just saw, I was just showing to my colleague these images of the royal family in a complete 80s getup, like very hip, right? You know, you would love those images. Like, they're full of colors and brightness, and they look as real as anything can be. People's jobs now, I mean, let's talk about in the film industry, right? Like, now you, there's so many AI websites, you can just drag and drop something, or you can tell it and it will manipulate everything. Is that something you feel, in your view, is at stake right now, unless there are some regulations put in place?
It's such a debate that I feel like every day I talk about.
I know.
No, it's a good thing. I want to talk about it. I think it's important. Do I feel like it's at stake? Yes. However, there's an artist I follow, and on one of his YouTube channels, he talks about that authenticity, and that in a weird way, unbeknownst, I feel like, to any of us going, oh, of course, that the prevalence of AI in our society for the common person, and I say that, like, if you are not involved in the art community and you're not as aware and you're seeing AI art, that people are actually looking at artists in terms of like painters, pencil artists, sculptors, yep, as having more value. So when somebody goes up to an artist and says, you drew that, that's not AI, you drew that. It's, before it used to be like, oh, that's cool, you drew that. And now it's like, oh, you actually put in the time and effort to develop this.
If you can talk about this, I know you mentioned you're in Atlanta for a project. Mm-hmm. What's on the horizon next? Like, what are you working on that's something that you can talk about?
I don't think I can talk about it quite yet. Unfortunately,
okay, then you can't. No worries.
I can't.
No worries.
But it's gonna be fun. I'll definitely say it's gonna be fun.
Is it coming out next year?
No. I think it would be, no, it wouldn't be next year. It would have to be the year after, at least.
Okay, so it's 2 years from now. Okay, so yeah, you're in very, very early stages then.
Very, very early stages, and fingers crossed. You know, the writer's strike, I'm totally in support of them and what they're fighting for. But that will affect a lot of people and a lot of productions that are in production or in pre-production right now.
Yeah. And is there anything on the horizon that you want to do besides art direction? Whether it's, I know you talked about earlier that at one point you thought you might be a director, or anything else that you want to touch upon, or this is your path?
I think this is my path for now. I would love to investigate the production designer role, I think, in the future. I would say continuing to be an artist and evolve my artistic skill set. Did it break up again?
Yeah, I'm not sure what happened, but go on, sorry.
Okay. So production design, but also just as a personal note of being an artist again. Sometimes when you're working in what we do, it's a lot of management skills, which is great, communication skills, spending the time to be that artist, and just try different skill sets, really.
Okay. Cool. That sounds great. Any word of advice to future art directors?
Oh, to future art directors, persistence. Keep going. Keep your heart in it, and keep learning. Speaking of things I'm doing right now, I've been taking Unreal classes, and Rhino classes. As an art director, you work a lot in 3D these days. Again, it's another tool and a skill to help advance my skill set. Like, always feel like you're a river and never a stale pond. That you're keep going.
Yeah.
Thank you. Keep growing. Keep learning. Keep curious. Keep curious and keep your heart in it.
Yeah. No, well said. That's so true. I think the day you think that you have figured it out all, that's the stepping stone of your demise. So, you know, I think we never figure out things that we think that we have. It's always an ongoing process of learning and trying to figure things out for our own growth and for our sanity at the same time.
Absolutely. That's such a great way of putting it. Yes. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Sam. I appreciate your time. It's been a delight talking to you. And hopefully, maybe we can talk in the near future about Jurassic World and then down the road whenever you have that next project that's public.
I would love to. Thank you. This has been such a pleasure.
Pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much, Sam. Have yourself a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.